Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, today I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Marjorie McKinnon. She is the author of Repair for Toddlers. And this is a book for entering a six-stage program with a 3 to 6-year-old that has been sexually abused. It's a book that is very timely, considering there's much exposure and talk about incest survivors right now. Margie is here to talk to us and to bring us more light in the topic of sexual abuse of toddlers. She is the author of the Repair series, Repair Your Life, Repair for Kids, and Repair for Toddlers. And this is the one we're going to be talking about today. And as well, she is the author of It's Your Choice, Decisions That Will Change Your Life. She is also the founder of The Lamplighters, a movement for recovery from incest and childhood sexual abuse that is currently has 74 chapters in 14 different countries. Hi, Margie.
Hi.
It's so great to be talking to you again, and this time with your new book, Repair for Toddlers. Congratulations on another book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was a while coming, and I didn't even realize there was a need for it at first until some of my facilitators started pointing out to me, "Wait, we need this, we need this." So
good, good. Well, I'm excited to be talking about it, that is for sure. But before we go any further, just in case we have some listening audience that doesn't know what repair stands for, let's start right from the beginning and explain what repair means.
Okay, repair is an acronym for the stages in the program. And the R stands for recognition, meaning that's when you finally go, oops, I think that's where my problems stem from, or yes, that did happen to me and I've been denying it or whatever, but you recognize that that's your problem. And the E stands for entry, and that's where you make the decision what kind of program you're going to work. Do you want to just work the repair program in the book? Do you want to go to a 12-step program in addition to it? Do you have a therapist that you want to bring in and do all three? Whatever you decide is best for you, but this particular part of the book guides you through the pros and cons of all of that. And then P is processing, and that's where you have a lot of techniques and exercises and just different things that you do that all come together to help you get to the next stage, which is A, for awareness, and by this time when you've gone through all these techniques and so on, you go, oh my God, I didn't realize that this was not my fault. You know, you start getting, you start putting it together like, you know, pieces on a puzzle. And the I is inside, and that's where you really, really become aware that it wasn't your fault. You were just the piece on a pawn on the chessboard. So those two kind of work together. And the last R stands for rhythm, and that's where you go back to that which you were before the sexual abuse happened, because I believe we are all born pure and innocent and whole, and we all have particular attributes that are singular to us. And then when we have been sexually abused, that part of us that's the real us is ripped away from us, and we can't get it back until we work this program. And then little by little, you'll start seeing, oh, my gosh, I can laugh. Oh, I never was able to laugh before. My dad wouldn't let me. You know, no laughing was allowed at our house or whatever. And, you start becoming the real you, and it's just an amazing transformation, but you have to make it through all of the other stages before you get to that last one.
So before we go any further on the book itself, you yourself are an incest survivor.
Yes.
And would you be willing to just briefly talk about it, too, so that our listening audience can understand where you are coming from?
Okay. When I was 13 years old, I was asleep in the bottom bunk in my bedroom, and somebody came in and did something that was so bad and hurt so much and was so shameful, and I started screaming and screaming and screaming, and my mother was a very heavy sleeper. By the time she got to my bedroom, my dad was standing in the hallway holding his robe closed, and I kept clinging to my mother saying, Mama, something happened, something really, really bad happened. Mama, help me, help me. But you see, at the age of 13, I didn't know anything about sex. I thought that you bought babies at the hospital. I had no idea what had been done to me. I only know what the impact was on me. And my mother kept telling me, no, you had a nightmare, go back to sleep. Well, I knew I hadn't had a nightmare. And a few weeks later, my mother figured out what was going on, and she had my dad get me up out of bed, and she began interrogating me in the middle of the night, you know, in the other room. Well, what's been going on in that room? You know, what's your dad doing? What's going on? I want to know. Tell the truth. And I kept saying nothing. And so my dad went and got, my mom said, get the belt, Bernie. And my dad got this big black leather belt, and she said, hit her. And he went ahead, and he just hit me with that belt. And I kept thinking I could leave my body. In fact, we had a Declaration of Independence hanging on the wall, and I kept trying to read it, thinking that if I got into that, I could pull myself out of my body, but I couldn't. And finally, I said, it's my fault, when I couldn't take it anymore. And my mother said, okay, go to your room. From that time on, our family life was just a nightmare, But for the next 5 years, I endured more beatings and more rapes and all kinds of emotional abuse. And finally, when I was 18, I ran away from home and spent the next, up till I was 45, going from one abuser to another.
Did your mother ever realize what was going on, or do you think she actually knew but totally went into denial?
I think that my mother knew what was going on, but her motto about my father, this is, you know, in the 50s, her motto was, even when he's wrong, he's right. And so my dad could get away with anything. She may have gotten confused about it towards the end of her life because she got breast cancer, and he didn't like doctors, said they were all quacks, so he got no help for her. And I found out later from her brother that as she was dying, she started to realizing she'd made some mistakes in regards to my father's, the way he ran the family. So, but I went back and put the pieces together, and I really think my mother had 4 kids in 4 years, and then there was no baby for 8 years, and then she got pregnant and had my little sister Jeannie, who she turned over to me to raise.
Okay.
And then there were no more babies at all after that, and I just think she didn't want any more, but they were a Catholic family, so there was only one way during those years when you avoided having children, that you didn't have sex, is what it was. And I think that's what happened until one day she finally had sex with him, and here came my little sister. And after that, there wasn't anybody, and so I think that contributed to him coming to me. And believe it or not, I've heard of an awful lot of families, especially Catholic families, where the mother is relieved to not have to have another child. If he wants to go after the daughter, then you'll at least leave her alone. It sounds really sick and like that can't be happening, but I know that it has in a lot of families.
Oh, my goodness, I just got goosebumps when you said that. Now, Marjorie, you were 13, and that seems to me that, you know, many people I've talked to, it seems that that's when the sexual abuse, the incest, really starts, maybe even sometimes at 11 or 12. But obviously that's because of the maturity. You know, you were starting to go through the puberty and probably, you know, looked pretty good. And especially when you say there was probably abstinence between your mother and father.
Actually, my mother set it off without even knowing what she was doing. I had a solemn communion ceremony in a Catholic church where I had to wear a white dress. This was after 8th grade. And, you know, go through our baptismal vows again. And so for the first time in my life, I had a store-bought dress, a Sears and Roebuck, and I had worn nylons and a garter belt. And I remember coming into the kitchen and swirling around, and my mother said, Bernie, look, our little girl is growing up. She's supposed to be a woman. And she reached over and pulled my dress up to show him my garter belt and nylons, and I tried to pull it down because I was a very modest young lady. And she chased me all over the kitchen, pulling that dress up over and over and saying, look at her, look at her. And I ran into my room, just cried. I was so ashamed. And a few weeks later, my dad started coming in my bedroom. So I think unwittingly, she took his mind and changed it from me being their little girl to me being his potential mistress.
Wow.
Twisted world, isn't it?
Sick. You know, it really is sick. And when I hear stories like that, it just gives me goosebumps. Now, this particular book is for toddlers. And, you know, I just don't even want to go into that but I know we will. But it's, like, appalling to think that actually incest would start with toddlers, babies.
A lot of it does. A lot of it does. We have, you know, we have a lamplighter chapter in our town, and I've had people at that chapter that have told me that they knew it started when they were like 2 and 3 years old. And it's some kind of a, I don't know whether it's power and control that this father feels over this daughter, or there's definitely a no boundary problem, and nothing is sacred because this is your child, and in some kind of stupidity probably thinks that this isn't going to really harm the child, and it does. Even if they are 2 years old and you think they can't remember that far back, from that point on, their whole personality and their life has changed. They've already been set up for many decades of more sexual abuse, because it usually doesn't happen just once, especially when it starts that young. It continues on, and I can't even. It's hard for me to envision. I love babies and I love little kids, and it's hard for me to envision harming a child like that. But they do. I mean, it's just, in Africa, we've got 15 lamplighter chapters in Africa, and in Africa, there's like an 86% sexual assault rate, and a large part of those are small children, and, you know, it's just, that's a whole separate worse problem than what's going on here in the U.S., but yes, it does happen, and these kids need help, too. And the book that was for kids, Repair for Kids, was from 6 to 12, and there's some things I had to redo so that they could get it better, because they couldn't get it quite, you know, when the Repair for Kids book. I had one of my facilitators that said she was trying to use the Repair for Kids book for, she had two children under the age of 6 who had been sexually abused, and she said it wasn't quite right. So she asked me if I would start a Repair for Toddlers, and so I worked with her. She gave me some ideas and told me some of the problems, and based on some of the things that she was guiding me through, I was able to adjust that book to a younger age.
So I have a couple of questions here, and I've written them down before I forget because they're important to me to know. Now, when you're talking about toddlers, is it in small children like that? Is it usually female? Is it usually the daughters? Or is it quite often that the sons are also being sexually abused?
Oh, it's both. It's both sexes. In fact, this one person that's in my chapter that tells me about what happened to her, father did it to every child that was in the family, the little girls and the little boys. And so, yeah, they don't. It's not just the girls. I think the girls have a higher percentage. It's one in four girls and 1 in 6 boys.
Uh-huh. Wow. You know, when I hear statistics like that, 1 in 4 girls, so when you put 4 women together, you know, you can look around and think, wow, one of those have been sexually abused, you know, and probably incest.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm wondering even if the stats are even higher, because how many people do not actually talk about it?
Well, I'm sure they're much higher because they don't talk about it, and they try not to think about it, and they don't want it brought up, it's so prevalent. People don't realize how prevalent it is. But, yeah, I'm like you. One time, I think it was in Safeway or something the other day, and I was looking around, and I happened to think of that statistic, and I thought, just think, one out of these 4 people in the produce department was sexually abused. You know, periodically that comes to my mind, and the numbers are just appalling.
Yeah, and, you know, you always, like in your case, you probably look at yourself, well, I'm one of them, but how many others?
Yeah.
You know, so, Margie, do you know if there's been research done as to why this happens, why incest happens, what goes on? You know, is it a sex addiction, or what goes on? I just have such a hard time understanding this.
Well, part of the problem is it's a multi-generational problem. If you have a perpetrator, he usually has been sexually abused himself when he was a child. Or, you know, like in my father's case, that's why part of the program is tracing your family history. And in my case, my father's father, when I tried to get information about that grandfather, because I didn't know him very well, what did you know about him from different relatives in the family? The one thing I kept hearing was no woman was safe with George Like.
Ah.
So that means my father was raised by somebody who cheated on his wife, who had boundary violations. And, you know, kids learn from their parents, even if they're not told this. They see it. They hear other things. So that's part of the problem, is it just keeps going down through the generations. I had a good friend of mine who was a chief of staff in preventive medicine one time that said, I think it stems from people not having a healthy sex life themselves. I mean, maybe the partners don't know anything about it or don't want to have healthy sex or whatever, and so they start seeking it in other areas. And there has to be some kind of a conscience problem there, I would think. I mean, you can't do that without it being in your mind, unless you don't have any conscience. I just think that most of these people are like sociopaths. They don't have any idea about right and wrong. And I know an awful lot of them, you know, like my third husband, when I told him that I just found out from his sister he had sexually abused her for 10 years when she was little, and that he had been sexually abusing his own daughter, he just looked at me like I was crazy and said, "What? No, that never happened." Mm-hmm. Well, through time, I found out that it did happen, and he blocked it out. or sometimes, you know, when these kids are little, they think they're going to do what you call play doctor.
Yeah.
When you wind up forcing somebody, you're no longer playing doctor. You are a perpetrator at that point. Nobody should be forced or have their boundaries violated. But if that child is not taught that he or she has the right to have boundaries, then they're not going to have any. And here comes this person who thinks he's going to get some kind of kick out of this.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with author Margie McKinnon. As you have heard so far, Margie can talk about sexual abuse and incest firsthand. And she has done much research and work with others so that they can cross that bridge into recovery. Keep on listening because there's so much more to come. You can also check her website, thelamplighters.org. So, you know, we keep talking about fathers being the perpetrators and, you know, with the incest. And do you find that work that you've done, that mothers also sexually abuse their children?
That does happen. I don't think it's as often as the fathers, but I have heard a lot of people who have talked to me about their mothers having done it to them.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I know it does happen. I don't think it's as prevalent. I really don't. I haven't heard as many stories about that as I have about the men.
It's about the men. And, yeah, me too. It's either, you know, fathers or sometimes brothers.
Brothers.
Right. Sometimes mothers. I've heard that. But, you know, I've never heard for anybody that I've talked to where a sister would sexually abuse a sister or a brother.
Oh, but I think that does happen.
Oh, I'm sure.
I remember my daughter, you know, I have three daughters, and the youngest one was raped at gunpoint when she was 17 while she worked at Taco Bell. And my two older daughters I found out halfway through recovery, they were sexually abused by my second husband. And so I had this, like, four out of four women in my immediate family. But my youngest one, the one that was raped at gunpoint, when she was, I don't know, 8, 9 years old, she was spending the weekend with a friend. And she came home early and said she did not want to stay with that friend anymore. And she told me that the friend made her take her clothes off and forced her to do things with her body that made her feel so yucky and so angry and so scared she didn't want to go over there anymore.
Wow.
And I just didn't know what to do about that because it was a very close friend. But I respected my daughter. Okay, you're not going over there. That's it. You're not staying there anymore. And looking back on it, this is long before I got in recovery, I probably should have gone to the mother and talked to her about it. Although, you know, mothers are very protective of their own, and there's an awful lot of, you got to be kidding, your kid made that story up. You know, so many people think you make this stuff up. Well, I'd say, if I was going to make up something, I'd make up that I won the lottery, but I wouldn't make up.
Oh, that's right. Oh, for sure. So let's talk about toddlers. Now, how do you, using repair, so obviously this book is for either as a parent or a therapist, but how is a child, let's say a two-year-old, so it's up to really the parent to recognize that there has been sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And then what happens then is like, how do you work with a two-year-old?
It basically, it's the same. I'm trying to pull up my Repair for Toddlers manuscript here so I can sort of explain to you as we're going along how that works. It starts out with, hello, little one, we are going to play a game. And there's illustrations in there. My husband did the illustrations for this book. And then I showed, no, it's not going to be games like this. And I show certain games that would play. And then we're going to play the game called Repair, and I've got a little owl sitting there reading the book Repair. It means to fix something that's broken, like they're doing in these pictures. So explain to the child, you know, what something broken could be like. You know, like you had this doll and you broke it and you'd want to fix it. So you give them examples, and there's some things showing in the book that shows when we were born, we were given a promise that we'd have the tools to live a joyful life, but then, you know, we become a wounded child when this happens. So little toddlers, you know, they explain what hurt means. You know what, you know, Susie, do you know what hurt means? Remember when you got your finger caught in the door the other day? Oh, boy, that hurt, didn't it? Yes. So Mama went and put some Band-Aid on it and some salve on it. And so you can explain that what happened to them was a bad thing that hurt them, that wasn't supposed to happen. So, you know, eventually they will go, yes, they know, they recognize, you know, that is what happened to them. Something was broken. You cry a lot, and you've got different things in your questions that ask the children about how they're feeling now. Uh-huh. Did you before this happened to you, you felt differently, didn't you? Know what have you been feeling since this happened to you? You know, most people don't ask their kids, how are you feeling? What are you feeling? How are you feeling? They just are so busy telling them what they're supposed to do and not do that they don't realize that there's a little tiny fragile soul inside that child, and that you need to know how it is feeling. I see you've been crying a lot lately. Can you talk to me about why you're crying?
Okay.
He explained to them about how they're going to go across the magical bridge of recovery and how over on this side there's all these dark things. You're having nightmares. You're crying. You're afraid. You don't like a door being half open. I mean, that was always my thing was if I saw a door half open, I would just in a panic run over and shut it as fast as I could. Even when I was, you know, 40 years old, I was doing that.
Because the door half open to you is not safe.
No, that's when my dad came into the room, he would open the door halfway, and he would stand there and stare at me, and then he would turn around and close the door. And so, yeah, door half open was really hard.
Through all this, Margie, you created lamp lighters. I'd like you to tell our listening audience about lamp lighters.
Well, Lamplighter actually started when I was in recovery and I was fumbling around in the dark. I joined this group and it wouldn't work, and that group and then helped some, but not enough. And I even flew out of state to go to seminars and you know, just all kinds, anything I could do. I was desperate for any kind of help. And I remember one time saying, oh, God, please give me a lamplighter. Why can't I get somebody to show me my way out of the dark? I'm so terrified and I don't know what to do. And then when I finished my recovery, I remembered that and I thought, what if I started a movement for people who have been sexually abused and they're all looking for a lamplighter? Oh, what if I call it the lamplighter? So I made the decision to do that. It took me quite a few years because my life at that time, then I'd moved from California to Colorado when I got married to my husband, and then we moved down to Arizona. So once I was in Arizona, you know, I started finding out that in the Verde Valley where I live, there's an awful lot of sexually abused people. There's a lot of meth problems, drug problems. So there you, when you get those kind of problems, you get a lot of domestic violence. And domestic violence, you get a lot of abuse. So I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to have people coming in by the hundreds. I'll start a chapter. Well, it doesn't work that way. I couldn't get anybody to come to my chapters. And then somebody, actually an agent for a book I was trying to put out, said, why don't you go national? Don't leave it right where you're at now. Go national. So my husband designed the website, and we put it out there, and then the first person that popped up was a gal in International Falls, Minnesota, that said, yeah, I want to start a chapter here. And so she did. And she did not know this, but International Falls was where I was born.
Oh, wow.
And that just, you know, when I was in recovery, I went to my father's grave, and I screamed and shrieked and hollered and carried on and, you know, got a lot of anger and hatred out of me. And one of the things I said at the end is, if you want to make amends for what you did to me, you will help me to get a movement going. You will help me to get my words out to help other people. And the fact that that first chapter started in the very town where my father, not only was I born there, my father delivered me when it was in the middle of a snowstorm and they couldn't get the front door open. And as a result, that created a bond between the two of us that was very, very strong. And so then, little by little by little, I started getting people from other states wanting to know what it would take. One person recommended, why don't you write a lamplighter guide so people can see how you set a chapter up. So I did that and made that, you know, I could email that to people if they wanted, you know, information on how to do it. And it just little by little, you know, today we've got 74 chapters in 14 countries, and, you know, 15 of those countries are in Africa.
Wow.
So it's every day I get somebody who wants to know, can I start a chapter? What do I have to do? They don't all decide they're going to, but I get a lot of requests for information.
Well, at least they're reaching out. And that's such a great service that you started.
And it's so simple. It's so simple, I mean, because people think, oh, no, that's just so much work. I don't want to do that. It's so simple. If you have you and one other person,
yes,
and you're having coffee at a coffee shop, and you've been sexually molested, and they have too, and they start telling the other person their story, and they start telling you their story, you just had a lamplighter chapter. That's all you need. And it's the telling of the story.
Yes.
I mean, I just... When I was writing that book, Repair, and I traveled around the country interviewing different people that had been sexually abused, asking them, what would you like to see in a program? And I was in Nebraska, and I was talking to a bunch of women at a park who were on their lunch hour, and I was telling them about what had happened to me and what I was doing. And one woman came forward, and in kind of a whisper, she said, why are you talking about this as if it wasn't your fault? And I said, it wasn't.
Wow.
She said, it wasn't? I said, no. I'm 13 years old. I'm laying in the bottom bunk. I got a rosary underneath my pillow. I think I'm going to be a nun. My dad comes in and rapes me. Now, what part of that is my fault? And the next thing I knew, she started telling me her story. And she had never told anybody before.
Wow.
So there's something about making it, putting it out there, making it okay. This is my story, and it is okay. Just like if you got burglarized and everything got stolen and you'd want to tell the police and your neighbors, they took all my jewels and my computer, you know, but what if it was your child? The silence is what is keeping this epidemic, because people don't want to talk about it. You know, they literally, I give talks, and I had a talk at a Lions Club a couple of years ago, and everybody in the room, when I was talking about what had happened, they turned their head away from me. Nobody wanted to look at my face. One man actually got up, turned his chair around, sat with his back turned to me the entire time. And I told him, I said, I know that this is a painful thing to hear about.
Mm-hmm.
How painful do you think it is for the victim? If you think it's bad for you, think about the person it happens to. And then I used that analogy of what if you came home and found out your television and your computer had been stolen? Why would you not call the police and tell all your family and your friends if it was your daughter's virginity that was stolen, her innocence? That would be way more important than a stupid television. But I have a granddaughter. I put a picture of her running on the beach in one of my new books called It's Your Choice, Decisions That Will Change Your Life. And I called her up and I said, honey, I just want to make sure it's okay with you if we use this picture on the cover of that book. And she said, is this going to be about one of your yucky sex books? She's 15 years old. My yucky sex books. It's not a pleasant subject. It really isn't. Nobody wants to hear about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. But by God, it needs to be made. It's almost like it needs to be made normal. I hate to say that, but that's what's going to bring it out.
Do you think, Margie, that there was more incest way back? Or, is it prevalent right now? Is it maybe more so that we're talking about it more? I just remember that, way back as I was growing up, I would hear little whispers, and now when I look back, I know what they were whispering about, and it was, the rumor mill going around that there was incest going on in such and such a family, but yet nobody talked about it. But now it seems to be more in the open, or is it just my imagination?
No, I think it's always been there. I mean, if you read the Bible, way back then it was okay. And so I think it's always been going on, and you're right. I think more and more people are talking about it now. There's more organizations that are working on the problem. There's 12-step programs for Incest Survivors Anonymous. There's a lot of books and material, to read. And so, it is coming out little by little. But what I've been able to find out, the numbers are not going down. Sometimes you hear people on their website, they'll say, the numbers are finally going down because we're looking at the problem. And then I'll go to where the real stats are, and I'll find out. They may tell you the numbers are going down, but they're not. They're getting worse.
Wow. That's not good to hear, that's for sure. But
No. Fortunately,
there are books like yours and Lamplighters, places where people can actually go and get help.
Yes, there are.
And hopefully stop that imprint. You know, you had talked earlier that this has been passed down for generations. And I also believe that by talking about it, by getting help, that's how it stops.
Yes.
It stops there, and that imprint that goes down for generations stops. And then from then on, hopefully a healthy environment for the child is there.
Right. And then they can grow up and know how to set boundaries.
Exactly.
And, know who to, stay away from, and you don't walk off with this guy in the park just because he said he's going to buy you ice cream, just.
Right.
Most kids just don't have boundary setting. The children of an incest survivor, they have never been taught how to set boundaries.
Well, then you look at it, and you probably, as you had mentioned too, the parents were probably their incest survivors, and they don't know how to set boundaries either. So how can they teach their child how to set a boundary?
Yes, I know. That's why we have to help. Get to the parents, and if we get to the parents, we can save the children.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, so many people say, I teach my kid how to not to go off with strangers. Well, most incest perpetrators are family members or family friends.
Exactly. And they're supposed to be the safe ones.
I know. So that you can't say, I've already told my kid not to go off with strangers, because you're not doing, you're not taking care of them that way.
Exactly. So let's tell our listening audience your website address.
Oh, it's www.thelamplighters.org.
And you use that as your personal, but also for the Lamplighters chapters.
Pardon?
Well. You also use this as for the Lamplighters chapters, but also as your personal website also.
It's for the Lamplighters, but I have book pages on each one of my books. It's also on the website.
Great, great. Gosh, Margie, thank you so much for taking the time talking to us, and I hope that the listeners just got, you know, some information that they know that they can go further and get your book, especially if there has been an incest going on in their families, either toddlers, as we're talking about today, or as children, or maybe that they were sexually abused within the family and, you know, in some incest situation. There is help. There is help. I'd like to say talking about it, finding somebody else that also has had experience, that is so healing.
Yes, it really is.
It really is. And thanks again, Margie. I really do appreciate you talking to us. And listeners, the book that we are talking about today is Repair for Toddlers, and by author Marjorie McKinnon. Check it out. She has a repair series. It's Repair Your Life, and this is for adults of incest abuse. She has Repair for Kids, and as I mentioned today, we're talking about Repair for Toddlers.
Thank you, Irene, very much for having me on your show.
And thank you. And listeners, this is Irene Watson from Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening.